My name is Josh Ellis. I'm the AMS Executive Director. I almost said Dorito. I'm the Big Cheese in Houston at the Union Baptist Association. So glad for you all to be here. We're going to talk about leadership today, and I really do. I mean, I have some slides and I have some thoughts, but it would help me. I think it would help each other if you push back, if you raise questions, if you're like, have you thought about this? Now, there will certainly be some heckling in the room. That's fine too, as long as you can give and receive. Okay, so I'm good with it. Let's just go. The title of this is Rethinking Leadership, Leading from the Middle. I'll explain the middle part in a little bit, but I want to get into the guts of what leadership is, how people do it, how does it work, and I also kind of want to start with the premises. I'm a leaders are made, you know, they're taught. Leadership is a skill. It's a bundle of skills that you learn, and you are not a leader unless you are leading people. So I've heard, you know, well, he's a natural leader, but he's not leading anything. Well, no, he's got some skills that could be good in leadership, but you're a leader when you lead. You'll be a better leader when you lead better, and you'll be recognized as a leader when you consistently lead well. And so we're going to talk about that. The other title for this, before I realized it was printed in a booklet and stuff, is Leadership Bakery. So I'm going to give you six ingredients that belong in every leadership recipe. And I'm going to talk about the three customers that as a leader you serve. Okay, so six, three. I find it's easier to break things up if it's not like nine or the 15 great characteristics or whatever. I haven't sold 10 million books, so I'm not taking shots at any Maxwell books. But six and three, okay? So that's what we're going to do today. And it starts with this, really like basic fundamental principle. You're not a leader unless you're leading someone. Now, someone's going to make the argument, someone's going to heckle and say, well, everybody's influencing someone, everybody's being watched, and I agree with that. And so, you know, to me, that reinforces the belief that leaders, you know, are made. They're not just born. You come into leadership context and you become a leader. Now, I will say about context is that those contexts change, and your leadership style has to change as well. And it starts with this. Leadership is a transaction of trust. Now, you put this into ChatGPT, you put this into Google, you're going to get a million leadership definitions that all involve trust in some way, shape, or form. You know, Stephen M. R. Covey wrote The Speed of Trust. That was kind of at the basis of this. Warren Bennis talked about it in his leadership classic. This is not, you know, this is not Josh Ellis, okay? This is not new information. But I do put on there that it's a transaction of trust. And what that means is that leaders have to trust followers to some degree, just as much as the followers have to trust the leader. Okay? And there is an exchange happening of trust, because otherwise there would be no leadership relationship. Does that make sense? Like, leadership really is a relationship. Nobody would be a leader if they didn't have followers that said, I need something from you. So we elect people, we vote for people, we show up and hear people because we trust them to provide something that we need. You know, whether it's legislation in the political form, or we follow a sports team because they think they're going to give us the championship that we need. Whatever it is, leadership is a transaction of trust. And it's one that I find young leaders don't put enough energy into in the beginning. They just assume if you stand up, you're the leader. If you're at the front of the room, that's the way it goes. I used to say the two cockiest groups of people in the world are fresh seminary graduates, assuming they're young, and military academy graduates. You know, the fresh butter bars. Anybody in here, officer?
Yes, sir.
Okay, any enlisted in here? Okay, you're smirking because you know what I'm talking about. There's a 22-year-old out there who just graduated from the service academy, and he stands up in front of a group of people and is told for the 4 years leading up to that, lead those men. And if you don't listen to the enlisted guys in that crowd, you're up for a really long tour, right? So leadership is a transaction of trust. Now, defining leadership beyond, you know, transaction of trust and other things is incredibly complicated. And so I found one of my favorite definitions of leadership. It's really not even a clean definition, but it's this paragraph written by two former Navy SEALs, and they write this, and it's worth kind of saying out loud. A good leader must be, and they must be, everything in their books is must be. A good leader must be confident, but not cocky. Courageous, but not foolhardy. Competitive, but a gracious loser. Attentive to details, but not obsessed by them. Quiet, not silent. Calm, but not robotic. Logical, but not devoid of emotions. Close with the troops, but not so close that one becomes more important than another or more important than the good of the team. Not so close that they forget who is in charge. Able to execute extreme ownership, which is the book that this comes from, while also exercising decentralized command. A good leader has nothing to prove, but has everything to prove. Now, I love that definition because it's messy. It's all over the place. It's full of dichotomies and paradox, and that is what leadership is. It's all these things, you know, confident but not cocky, nothing to prove but everything to prove. Like, that's what leadership looks like. Now, in our world, in the world of believers, Don Howell writes this about what biblical leadership is. And he would even probably say biblical servant leadership. But he writes, biblical leadership is taking the initiative to influence people to grow in holiness and to passionately promote the extension of God's kingdom in the world. Now, I love that definition because, one, it says that leadership is taking the initiative. Right? Leadership is not a passive activity. But especially for our work, taking the initiative to influence people to grow in holiness and to promote the kingdom of God, you know, that's what we do, right? And we work with churches so that this end is accomplished. Now, one of my favorite all-time definitions for leadership is Gary Uchel, and this is he's a leadership scholar, writes all about leadership theories, and after looking at all these different theories, he comes up with this. It is the process of influencing others to understand and agree about what needs to be done and how to do it. So stop and take a breath there for a second. The process of influencing others to understand and agree about what needs to be done and how to do it. So for some of you, that is both vision and strategy. There's the hill that we're going to take. This is how we're going to take it. And he follows that up with the process of facilitating individual and collective efforts to accomplish shared objectives. Again, that transaction of trust. If only the leader wants to take the hill, he's only going to get people to accomplish that goal through coercion or power or blackmail or whatever it is. He's not going to lead. And if only the followers want to take that hill and they don't have a leader, they won't get it done. Okay? And so there's two processes kind of going into what leadership is. Now, for our purposes, I want you to think about two dynamics. One is context, and one is leadership activities. Okay? We're going to talk about both of those in a pretty extensive form here today. But if you look at this definition, you see that he's talking about context first. He says the process of influencing others to understand and agree. So that process of working with people, you know, it's the people that matter. Right? A different group of people is going to require a different level of influence or a different means of communicating that. And so first you have context. And then you have leadership activities. You have this understand and agree about the problem, the solution, and accomplishing those objectives. That's the guts, the what do you do, the activity of leadership. And then it comes back to facilitating individual and collective efforts, and that's back to context. Okay? So you have context, leadership activities, and then context again. So I'm going to give you an equation. I'm a numbers guy, but I'm not a math guy. So I put this equation into Google to make sure it said what I thought it said. Then I put a different form in there, and I was like, I think that's the same thing, but let's just make sure. If anybody is in here a math guy and the equation doesn't work the way I said, I have a problem with the internet, okay? So, value-driven good leadership, okay? Because, and let me stop there. Leadership is value neutral, right? You have some phenomenal leadership being done by some morally derelict people, right? There are some phenomenal leaders out there that lead people to do really, really bad things, okay? That doesn't mean it was bad leadership. It means it was great leadership to bad ends. By the way, if any of you are ever thinking about doing a PhD in leadership, that's the trick question that they will start with on the first cohort of the program. They'll stand up in a room and say, was Hitler a good leader? And they're just begging you, say he was a terrible leader. Okay, but that's the trick answer. He was a phenomenal leader with no morality or ethics. And so, so if we're going to talk about what good leadership is, value-driven leadership, then it looks like character applied to or multiplied by this ratio of activities over context. Okay? So, for the two of you that really like equations, there's your leadership equation. Now, let's talk about context for just a second. I'm going to break all of your contexts into three groups. And even as you're thinking about it, you're thinking, well, I have, in my context, more than a third of my churches, about a quarter of my churches are Hispanic, Spanish-speaking. About a quarter of my churches are African-American. A little bit more than that. So I only have an association that's predominantly Anglo to the tune of about one-third. Okay? So two-thirds of my association is non-Anglo. So within my association, if I look at it as a whole, I've got three groups. I've got a front group, a middle group, and a back group. Very creative titles. Okay? And even if I wanted to segment that into, well, let's just talk about my Hispanic churches within my association, I'm going to tell you that within that group, I have a front, middle, and a back. Now, what do I mean by front, middle, and a back? How many people like hiking? Anybody? Okay? Some of you are like, no. Okay, that's all right. So I grew up in Colorado. Hiking is just a thing that we did. And we have tried to raise my two Texas-born children into loving elevation and hills and all that. It's hard in Houston because Houston's as flat as this carpet right here. But we take them on hikes a lot. And a couple things invariably happen on hikes. The crowd that you go with, now even if it's my family of four, we will split into three groups. Okay, my oldest son is my achiever. He is my accomplishment kid. And he will be the first to the destination of the hike, regardless of if it's just a point that we decide to turn around and come back. My oldest son will be there first. Okay, I call him my scout. And I tell him, I'm like, dude, you gotta stay. He's 14 now, so he's a lot more resistant to this instruction than he used to be. But I'm like, you've gotta be within at least eyesight. Okay? And he's like, well, Dad can see pretty far, so okay, let's go. You know, but that means every time you go around a bend, you gotta stop, right? I can't see you anymore. But he's my front guy, you know? Now, my youngest son, I have two. My youngest son, he's in the back. Okay? And he's not in the back because he hates hiking. He's not in the back because he's resistant to this idea. He's in the back because this kid soaks everything up. Right? So every step of that hike, he is looking for a stick to pick up. He's looking for a rock that's in a particular shape. He's telling me and my wife a story. And I mean, the dude doesn't know the meaning of the word hurry. You know? He's one of those, hey, you're late for school, hurry. And he's like, I am. And I'm like, no, that's walking. Okay? I mean, like, accelerate your walk. Let's call it a run. You know? He's just meandering, you know? And so where does that put me as the leader of this hike? Okay? If I stay with my oldest son, then I'm going to lose my youngest son and probably my wife, who knows better than to leave him alone in a forest. Right? If I stay with them, I'm going to lose my oldest son because he's gone. Right? I need to constantly be bringing him back. So my position is leading in the middle. Okay? It allows me to have access to both groups. Now, what does that mean if you're not talking about children on a hike? Let's talk about that. So you'll have people in your context. They've bought the vision. They get it. They love it. They want to accomplish something with it. And so those are the people who are coming to you saying, okay, what hill are we taking? And you say, that one. And they're like, great, I'm on it. Boom, and they're gone. Right? You have anybody in your life that's like that?
Yeah.
I've got pastors in my association, they're like, dude, I'm sold. Like, I don't need the pitch anymore. I don't need the slide deck. I need objectives, right? Because I'm going to accomplish those objectives. And boom, they're gone. I also have people in the back group who are not sold on the vision, right? Or I haven't invested enough trust in them. Or they are resistant, right? Whatever their reason for being in the back is, there, and I'm not looking at you, but there is a guy just in the back all the time doing this, right? Earn it. Prove it. Let's see. I'll bet not. Like all of those phrases, like those, that's their favorite bumper sticker. And so I, as a leader, have to make a choice again about, do I stay with the scouts? Do I stay with the guys who are just going to run ahead and get everything done? Am I going to stay with the guys in the back? Who, they may be resistant, and they frankly may be hurting, you know? Or am I going to stay in a position where I know where both of those groups go? Now, if you've noticed anything, you've noticed I haven't defined the middle group. The middle group is defined by not being one of the other two, okay? They're not scouts, and they're not hanging back being belligerent or wounded or resistant or anything else. They're hanging in the middle, which is where most people are on most things. Right? If you've ever read Rogers' Diffusion of Innovation, it's where we get terms like early adopters, laggards, and all of that. This is very similar to that. But on that diffusion curve, he basically says 68% of people, which is one standard deviation plus or minus, are in the middle. Right? They're not going to be the first to buy the new iPhone. They're not going to be the last ones using a flip phone. They're going to be somewhere in the middle. Right? They're always going to be probably one edition or two editions behind the newest thing and one or two ahead of the oldest thing. Right? They're going to be in the middle. So, before I go any further, I'm going to really rely on kind of this front, middle, back terminology, but I want you to understand that this is not a way of segmenting or typecasting your people. Okay? Because depending on the issue and depending on the thing, someone may be in the front and wanting to really accomplish that goal, and they may be in the back. And I have a teenager, so, I mean, he's all over the map on any given day. You know, just kind of depends on his mood. But what I am saying to you is if you learn to recognize front group behavior as opposed to back group behavior, as opposed to what you do when you're actually leading in the middle, it will help you understand how to motivate, how to relate to, how to pastor well, how to lead well, this entire group of people that's under your watch. Okay, so front, middle, back. Now, any football fans in here? Anybody happy that it's football season already? Could be college or pro. I'm not, you know, I know there's some serious college football people in here. Anybody know what this picture is from? It's 2018. It happened in Minnesota. And there is a New Orleans Saints, no offense to my Louisiana guys, but there's a falling down New Orleans Saint right here. What had happened was Case Keenum, University of Houston graduate, Case Keenum, had just completed a 27-yard pass to Stephon Diggs. He shed his one guy who was covering him and then scampered to the end zone so that they would win and complete a 17-0 comeback in order to go to the NFC Championship game the next week where they got slaughtered by Philadelphia. Okay? Now, the New Orleans Saint, Marcus Williams, he misses the tackle. Stephon Diggs runs to the end zone. Yay, everybody's happy. Now, here's the thing. On any given team, in any given moment, you're going to have a front crowd, right? That's the guys on the field. So Stephon Diggs and the rest of the offense, they're the front crowd in that moment. Calling the plays, getting it done. Now, there is a middle guy, right, or a middle crowd, and this is actually, you know, I circled him. This is a captain on the defense, okay? You wouldn't assume personality-wise that he isn't a front group guy, but in this particular context, because they're not on defense, he's in the middle. He's waiting to go in. He's waiting to get it done. There's also back group guys. And in this case, this is one of their players who was rehabbing an injury. So he wasn't in the back group because he was belligerent or anything else. He was there because he needed to heal. And then he would eventually regain. And then the favorite guy in the picture is this guy in the yellow circle. I don't know anything about him. I just love the fact that Stephon Diggs had just caught this pass. The whole Minnesota bench is going crazy. And there's one guy on the Minnesota bench going, we're going to score. Like, that's his reaction. So, he doesn't have anything front, middle, or back. I just think if you're going to look at this picture, that guy's got to get a shout out. So I give him one. So if you want to use, different analogies for front, middle, back, like in football, I would say there are players playing, there are players preparing, and then there are players healing. Okay, so playing, preparing, healing. If you wanted to use like a shopping analogy, then you would say the front group, they're sold, right? They have bought the thing, they have walked out of the store, receipt in hand. Then there are shoppers who are intent on buying something at some point. And then there are people who are just browsing, right? And if you look at your leadership context, whether it's the association or a church or something else, you know that there are people in your life and under your leadership that fall into all three of those categories, right? Sold, shopping, browsing, players preparing, healing, whatever it is, I go with front, middle, back because I'm a pretty simple guy. Now, the pushback that I always get on this is, what about that fourth group? What about the people that won't go? Right? They're not just, dragging their feet in the back group. They're like, not me. So we've got a hang glider in this picture. That's the fourth group. The fourth group is a group that you don't lead. Okay? So what I'm telling you is you've got three groups in your context, and then you have a fourth that is outside your context, and you have no influence over them. You have no leadership over them. There's no transaction of trust, and that's okay. That's okay. So I'm going to give you this quote. As painful as it may be, good leaders need to recognize the difference between those who need encouragement to be part of the team and those who need that same encouragement to only continue doing it on their own. Leaders can certainly afford to be encouraging to both kinds of people, but the former, the ones that need encouragement to be part of the team, those are the ones that you should invest in, right? And the latter group, you encourage them because it's the right thing to do. Okay? But don't get hung up on that fourth group. They're hovering above you or off to the side of you. They may be even going the same place that you're going. So you're going to end up at the finish line, and you're going to see these people, and you're going to be like, hey, hold on. You just didn't want to get there with us? And yeah, that's the answer. And so, don't take it personally. You don't have to lead everybody. They're not in your charge, right? Their sheep belong to another shepherd. And so there is that fourth group. So let me pause here. What questions, pushback, moans, whines, complaints, anything about these three groups? Is this tracking with you? Some of you should have eaten more Sour Patch Kids because you're not awake yet. I know it's nap time. It's brutal. I get it. All right, I'm going to keep going.
That's just a quick question.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you spend any time or energy trying to move the fourth group even into the browsing?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
If they do,
fine. Yeah. They'll probably come in through the third group. But I really like... I really try and focus on if I have a transaction of trust with someone and they need something from me as a leader, or I need something in them as a leader, those are the relationships that I prioritize. The ones out there that I can't control, don't have any influence in, don't have any trust built in, nope, I don't spend any time on them. And that's, you can chase those people. But what I have found is the more that you chase someone who doesn't want to be caught, you just get tired. So, and there's plenty of other things in leadership to make you tired besides chasing those people.
So if you were to describe that classic church that's in the fourth category, how would you frame it?
Barely involved in the association, barely paying attention to their community, existing to just exist. The country club churches. I worked for one of these churches early on in my career, and we had a guy who watched the parking lot. Right? Stood by the back door. We've seen this before, right? And he said he wanted to greet people. What he actually wanted to do was size up the visitors that might be coming to see if they're going to match. That's what he was doing. This church didn't want to grow. Didn't want to reach anybody. Didn't want to be involved in collaborative efforts. Didn't want to do anything. Okay. But I, as a leader, am not going to spend time on you when you don't want me to spend time on you. Now, this is where a lot of the chirping is going to come from, you know. But some of that, now, I'm a big fan of constructive criticism, okay? And I think there's a lot of, now I did my PhD dissertation on narcissism and pastoral leadership and the possible relationship there. So I'm going to probably obsess about not being a narcissist a little more than your average person, because you read nothing but narcissism for 3 years and it gets into your head. In fact, you start getting a reputation because people are like, hey, I heard something about narcissism and you were the first guy I thought of. I'm like, that's not good. They're like, no, I didn't mean it like that. I'm like, oh, I'm fine. I won't sleep for 3 days. Days now, that's good. But I'm a big fan of constructive criticism. The chirping and the noise that comes from, you know, like if you go back to the football analogy, all the three groups that I mentioned were part of the team. The guy wearing the replica jersey sitting in the stands going, oh, you're terrible, get another job. I don't care what he thinks. You know, yeah, I want him to buy a ticket, you know, if I'm that football team. But as a player, I'm not playing for him. I'm playing for the team. Right, we have an objective that's apart from his little nickel and dime attitude. So, any other good questions though? Any other questions about this? Front, middle, back, we're still there? All right, so let's talk about if front, middle, back is your context. Let's talk about the consistent activities, and I will tell you, leadership is a consistent set of activities that constantly change. Does that make sense? A consistent set of activities that constantly change. So again, going to kind of the baking analogy, did you know that there are 6 ingredients in almost every baking recipe? Just 6, okay? So you need eggs, flour, salt, a leavener, like baking soda, and did I say sugar? And butter, okay? Those are your 6 ingredients. And whether you are, you know, making toast, whether you're making a croissant, making a cinnamon roll, or a donut, if I get a vote, it's a donut, you're going to use all of those things. The only originality in baking comes in the difference in the quantities of those ingredients and the spice or the add-in that you bring to it as a baker. And so you need a cinnamon roll, you're going to need those ingredients, and you're going to need cinnamon. You know, well, you don't need that for a croissant. So you're going to bring something else. So if you are working with these ingredients as a leader, I'm going to tell you that there are 6 things as a leader that go into every leadership recipe. And you, as the leader, are going to determine how to vary those amounts and vary those activities depending on your context. So what are the 6? Here are the 6. Build trust, cast vision, encourage, serve, equip, and resource. Okay, those are the 6 things that you're going to do as a leader. And obviously, these are big umbrella terms, and you know there's a lot of meat under each one of these, and we're going to talk about it a little bit. But you as a leader are going to bring these 6 ingredients to every leadership recipe that you ever do. And you're going to vary them depending on whether you're leading people in the front, the middle, or the back. So let's look at each of these real quickly. So the first is build trust. If leadership is a transaction of trust, okay, you don't just lead at the speed of trust, but it is necessary. It is the foundation for leadership. If there's a transaction happening, then you need to build trust with your people, right? Regardless of the context, there will be an element to this. Now, a lot of this is going to be dependent on what people value, because that's where trust is derived from. So you're going to have integrity. You're going to have to encourage people to provide feedback. If you're a team leader and your team is not giving you the truth and they're not, you know, speaking up, you can't possibly lead without all those assumptions covered. You have to set an example. People really value not just credibility, but just the thought that a leader is going to do what he says he's going to do, he's going to be who he says he's going to be, and he's going to do that whether he's standing up on stage or whether he's shopping at Target, right? You've got to set an example. And then this whole balance, visibility and invisibility, It comes from Elmore's book, The Eight Paradoxes of Leadership. If you haven't read that, it's fantastic. It's phenomenal. Highly recommend it. In fact, on our website, it's one of the books that we did a summary for this year because it's great. But he's the one that says there is an element to being really visible as a leader, and also there are times where you as a leader need to step back and either let other people lead or let the processes that you put in place actually execute. If you as a leader are needed every single second of the process, then you're not leading empowered people, right? You're literally just beating sheep into place. So there is a balance there. So build trust, I think, is pretty obvious. And then cast vision, right? You can't read a leadership book without vision being in there. This is a core component to leadership. You know, we could get all into the difference between leaders and managers and all of that stuff, but you've got to be able to have what Cotter says, a compelling vision. It has to be imaginable, desirable, feasible, focused, flexible, and communicable, which means it can't be so grandiose. You know, we're not just going to take that mountain over there. We're going to take that mountain range over there. I have no idea how we're going to do it. But wouldn't everybody like to take that mountain range over there and you get the crowd all whipped up and yeah. Is that feasible? No, it's wildly beyond our budget and our capabilities. I have no concept of how we're going to actually get that done. But isn't it desirable? I mean, that's not the only thing, right? Vision is a preferred future, but vision is also attainable. It's feasible. And then Bowman and Deal, this comes from Reframing Organizations, which is another phenomenal book. It's the best leadership book you've never read. Okay, and I say that all the time. I would give it out like candy, but it's like 389 pages long. Because Bowman and Deal are leadership scholars. They both teach. But it is the best summary of leadership out there. Like, bar none. You can get one edition back for next to nothing on Amazon. If you get the current edition, it's going to cost you $75 or more. So go one edition back. It's great. But they say vision turns an organization's core ideology or sense of purpose into an image of the future. So a vision is the embodiment of your values. You know, visions have to be forward thinking. They have to be challenging, right? Nobody gets excited to say, well, instead of that mountain over there, we're going to take this parking spot right here. Right? That's not vision. It could be a good strategy, like everybody likes a good parking spot, but you know, you're not redefining your world and executing your values based on something that was this easy to attain. Right? It's got to be challenging. It also has to be hopeful, and again, we're talking about good leadership here. The vision has to be a thing that you communicate that inspires action. Okay? And then there is an element of strategic planning in there. Again, can't go get the mountain if there is no plan to get that done. So, build trust, cast vision, encourage. This is the element of my leadership that I have to work on the most. It is not my natural. My natural is sarcasm, which my wife tells me not everybody finds encouraging. And I was shocked to learn that, but I believe her because she's pretty smart. This is part, and really, Kuzis and Posner write about this a lot in their book. But leaders get the best from others not by building fires under people, but by building fires within them. That's so instructive to me because I'll tell you, that's not the parenting system that I grew up under. Right? There was constantly a fire under me, you know? I didn't grow up in an abusive home or anything like that, but it was like, man, get this done. Get some results. Whatever. You know, I was 12 years old the first time I heard I was not going to have any route to college unless I figured it out for myself. I mean, my mom was just telling us the facts. We were poor, you know, like, not really poor, but we ate a lot of ramen noodle soup. You know what I'm saying? And I didn't figure out why we did that until my first grocery shopping trip in college, and I was like, oh, it's 7 cents a packet. That's why we ate it all the time. That and instant oatmeal, you know? You know, encouraging people, and let me tell you this, there are some really good visionary leaders out there that are not encouraging. There are some really good encouraging leaders out there that can't cast a vision. You know, I've worked with some great pastors over the years, and one, like, he's the most likable guy in the world, right? He does everything right. All the people skills, I mean, he's just got people skills coming out of his ears. But he doesn't have any vision. So he rotates through a core of leaders about every 2 or 3 years because he's so likable. Everybody wants to be near him. And then they go, what do you want us to do? And he never has a good answer. And so leaders want to lead, especially that front group. They want to execute. And so if you can't give them something to execute, you can't just be encouraging. Right? This is a component to it. There are some kind of big bullets under here. Establishing a culture of encouragement. Again, this is one of the things that I'm really kind of leaning into. Telling stories that can be retold. You know, they talk about it in their book, about recognizing someone's achievement, not just, hey, they had this many sales in this quarter, or they did this, but saying, hey, I know a story about Sally, and she went out of her way to help this pastor, and now they're thinking about people groups in a whole different way, because she spent a half an hour at this church, and now they have a thriving ministry to the Burmese in our community, and that church has multiplied twice, a lot because of her involvement in that church. Now, the story is not, hey, we have two more churches or another people group engaged. It was, hey, Sally really came alongside this church and exposed them to how to engage an unreached people group. If Sally can do that, we can do that, right? And so you establish that in the culture. Serving. We had a great conversation at lunch today about leadership and service. The two things go together. You know, there's an entire body of research around servant leadership. But especially for us as Christians, we cannot expect to be leaders if we don't serve people. It's just wildly unrealistic. You can be in leadership environments where you don't have to serve. You usually come with a title called king, dictator, you know, whatever. But we're expected to be the hands and feet of Jesus. We are expected to serve people. And Max DePree wrote in his classic, he wrote, the first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. The last is to say thank you. In between the two, the leader must become a servant and a debtor. My favorite thing to say to pastors is, I work for you. I work for you. You pay my salary. I'm here for you. And I tell pastors all the time, look, you're going to serve in some environments where you got to be the guy with all the great ideas. I get that. I'm happy whispering from offstage. And if you need someone to get shot at, you know, because there's some truth that needs to be told, there's an idea that needs to be put out there, I work for you, man. I'll go up on stage. I'll say those things. I mean, as long as I believe in them, I'm not going to be a puppet. But, you know, I'll take a bullet for you. I've got an office to go back to, and you got to stay here and live with these people. Right? I work for you. It's one of my favorite things to tell people. And Gene Wilkes wrote in Jesus on Leadership, servant leaders serve the mission and lead by serving those on mission with him or her. So we've got to serve. We've also got to equip. Now, I'm going to tease out the difference between equip and resource here for a second. And this is where I think there's a real room to push back. But in my world, at least in my thinking, you have to equip the people that you are leading to do the things that they want to do. Right? So leadership is that transaction of trust based on shared objectives. If you cannot equip them to accomplish the vision, then you're doing nothing but talking about it. You're just hoping for it. And there's a big difference between a hope and a dream and a vision. And so you've got to be coming alongside leaders and equipping them to do that. And some of that, you'll see this first bullet point, some of that's just building their confidence. You know, you can't, when I was leading my children to learn how to swim, right? Part of it was just getting my children in the water, right? You are not going to drown. You can let go of the wall. You know, I'll be here to catch you. The same thing, you know, riding a bike. You know, I'm leading you to learn this skill. It starts with me running alongside you, and then eventually I'm going to let go. You know, and you're going to be fine. You're going to balance. And even if you fall, you're going to get back up. You're going to try it again. It's going to work. But you've got to build that competence and that confidence, and those things are different. You have to dedicate time and resources. We're going to tease this out in a second. But you have to dedicate effort to the equipping of your people. You also have to ensure that there is a pipeline of people going through that leadership development process. Because, again, if you think of yourself, and I hope you do think of the association as a sending agency, Like, we want to lean into our churches so that they will raise up people called to the Great Commission, called to Great Commission tasks, and then go and do those things. So in my role, I can't just say, hey, call out the called and then hope you figure it out. You know, I'm going to say, hey, call out the called and we will come alongside you. And maybe there's a group that needs training. Maybe there's a group that needs practical experience, whatever it is. But it's not good enough to just talk about it. You've got to be able to do it. And then investing while accepting risk. So leadership is a transaction of trust. And a lot of people intuit that from the follower perspective. They're like, well, yeah, followers have to trust leaders. You know, otherwise, you know, what would we need them for? But leaders also have to trust followers, and there's risk in that, right? To go back to the military example, you jump out of a trench or a foxhole, or you go around a corner and you go, follow me, and there's nobody following you, you're about to be really lonely and probably dangerously exposed. So you've got to know that your people have been equipped and have bought into the vision and trust you as a leader and have been encouraged enough so when you go around that corner, you have people right on your back. Right? That is part of equipping. Now, part of equipping, or really related to equipping, is resourcing. So I can't, you know, my father-in-law is a phenomenal woodworker. Could build a house from scratch if he was really so inclined. Like, he's that good. And to have a father-in-law with that level of craftsman skills is great once you get past the overwhelming intimidation of that, right? Because I am not what you call handy. You know, like, YouTube helps me repair almost everything that I have ever touched. But before I go to YouTube, I see if my father-in-law is busy. You know, because if he's not, I'm happy to hand him tools and, you know, be whatever, however available he needs me to be as he fixes my house. Okay? But it would be silly for him to learn all those skills, to get the equipping, and then never do anything with it. So resourcing is the environment that you put people in so that they can use the things that they have learned. So some of this involves system thinking. Some of this involves, like, you know, it's one thing to say to churches, hey, we hope you call out future missionaries. And we will even put a cohort together and you'll learn all the skills. But then we never put them in an environment where they can use those skills. What a waste. What a waste. So I've got to think through, how do I put people who are trained and equipped and passionate about these things and who are trusting me to provide them with an environment to do that? And some of that is just, I mean, resources can mean resources. Some of that means it's not just enough to buy somebody a book. Now we have to invest in them, whether it's, you know, a co-vocational role, maybe it's a volunteer opportunity, whatever. But this is all part of resourcing, you know, putting the systems in place so that you can use the skills that you have. Does it make sense? That's why I differentiate equipping from resourcing. So now let's look at this in our different contexts. So if those are the six activities, the consistent set of activities that constantly change depending on your context, what does that look like for this front group? Okay? If I'm building the leadership recipe, here's what it looks like for the front group. They don't need trust. You don't need to spend time as a leader building trust with your front group. Why? Because they already trust you. They've already bought into the vision. But now, vision is really high because they are constantly getting something done and coming back and saying, what's next? Okay? Don't spend time building trust with them. You know, don't go through the whole slide deck with them. They've got it. They want to know what hill and by when. Right? And so, you've got to constantly be casting that vision. You've got to constantly be encouraging to them. Now, why do you need to encourage the front group? Somebody tell me. Why does this group need encouragement almost as much as you can possibly go?
Where nobody else is going.
That's exactly right. Because being a scout is lonely. Right? Being a scout means seeing things that nobody else is going to see, maybe experiencing hardships that no one else is going to experience, and doing it all without the safety of the big group. Like, they're out there. I mean, taking the hill may mean crossing some weird territory. You know, starting a program from scratch means turning that flywheel and getting people enthused and energized and dealing, you know, church planting. You know, church planters need tons of encouragement because they're going to throw open the doors and six people are going to show up. And they're going to go home and go, maybe I'm not called to do this. Or maybe it was, you know, 4th of July weekend, bro. You know, like, I wouldn't take that personally. But scouts need the encouragement. Those guys who are exposing themselves to risk, who are going to get the job done, they need to know that you as a leader have their back. Now, you need to serve them in a way that helps them get the job done, gives them the freedom to run and accomplish those things, but they already have the equipping. So don't send someone who is educated to do the task to more school. Does that make sense? If they have the equipping that they need, turn them loose. Say, go, man. Don't spend more time in classes, more reading the books of stuff you already know. Let's get it done. And usually, people in the front group, they won't get more equipping than they need because they're resistant to it. You know, they're like, oh, this is an hour talk. Could it be 30 minutes? Because, you know, I got places to be. I get that. They need tons of resourcing. Tons of resourcing. They've already got the skills, right? They've already got the tools. They need the environment to use those things to accomplish the vision that they're buying into. Right? That's the front group. So now, let's look at the back group. This is the back group. The back group, regardless of why they're back there, you know, maybe you're the new leader in town and they're just deciding whether or not they're going to wait you out. Right? Maybe they're really resistant to the vision that you have cast. Maybe they're coming from an environment of church hurt. The next church they land in, it doesn't matter who the pastor is, he's going to have to spend some extra time with them because they've been burned. Maybe they just don't like change. By the way, most people don't like change. The only time people like change is when it's their idea. Then everybody's 100% in. Right? Right now, my family's back in Houston. Nothing will change about my house while I'm gone. Nothing. You know, my wife likes it exactly the way it is. The furniture's all where it needs to be. The walls are all the color they need to be. Whatever. She's leaving town in 3 weeks. I already planned on painting 3 rooms. Now, I'm not going to move the furniture because I'm not stupid. And I did get her approval of the colors in case any of you think that this is the last public thing I'll ever attend in my life. So I'm not a moron. But I'm like, oh, well, she's going to love it when she gets back. She just doesn't want to do the change. I got this, okay? She's going to travel. She's going to talk about her books. I'm going to be at home. I'm going to be painting stuff. Everybody likes change when it's their idea. Most people don't like change. So in this back group, when you're leading them, you're going to spend time on top of time on top of time just building trust with these people. You know, give me baby steps. Give me a day. Give me a week. Give me an hour. You know, and it's going to feel exhausting, especially if you and your temperament tend to lean toward the front group in most things. You're going to be like, oh, this back group is killing me. I can't tell you how many young leaders think that this group is the fourth group. You know, if you're not ready to jump on the bandwagon immediately, then what am I doing even spending time with you? Here's the answer to that, by the way, in case you're going to chase that. So if you only lead leaders, you only lead that front group, every time a new initiative comes up, you're going to be dealing with a smaller and smaller group of people. Because very rarely is someone uniformly an innovator. You know? Very rarely. And so if you as a leader are like, well, innovators are my people. Those are the only thing. So you might get 4% of people. Well, that 4% is going to be cut in half the next time, because some of those innovators are like, nah, but that's not my thing. And then the next time you have an idea or something comes up, you're going to say, well, I'm sticking with the leaders on this. That group's going to get cut in half again. Meanwhile, the people in your charge are just taking up a larger and larger column behind you. Right? So, this group doesn't need vision. Right? And this is the part where most leadership scholars throw me right out the window. This group doesn't care about your vision. They don't care about the vision because they don't trust you. And it could be a world-changing vision. It could be compelling. It could be relevant to them. It could be all the things that visions have to be. But if you don't have trust with those people, they don't care. And it's not that they're not caring people, right? You understand the difference. It's that you don't have the credits to work with in the bank account to be able to say, this is how life should change for you. Because that's what a vision is. A vision is a preferred future. Life will be different if we accomplish this vision. If it's big enough, the world will be different because we accomplish this vision. But until they're ready to really trust you, they don't care what the vision is. So, correspondingly, they need tons of encouragement. And it could be just little things, right? But that building the trust and that encouragement goes hand in hand. You have to serve these people. You have to show up. You have to be there. You have to counteract all the negative things that they sized you up with immediately after meeting you and not knowing you at all. You got to work against all of that, whether that's a stereotype or not. And that is done through service. That's done through integrity. So building trust and service go hand in hand. You can equip them, but I wouldn't spend a ton of time on it. You know, you can equip them while they don't trust you. You know, if you're building trust, you are also adding tools to their toolbox. You're also kind of investing in them. But you don't have to resource these people. They're not going anywhere, right? They're not going to take this thing that you just did and magically flip the switch. Now we trust you. Now we bought the vision. Where do we go? That doesn't happen with the back group. Okay? And so while you do some equipping, you don't need to resource. You don't need to find a system for them to work in. Now, what about the middle group? Go ahead, laugh. Get the snot, you know. Because I thought the same thing. When I first came up with this, I'm like, this is the dumbest slide ever. You know? It's like, just do all of it. But here's the reason. Most of your people are in the middle. Right? Most of your people are somewhere between the back of the front group and the front of the back group. Does that make sense? Did I say that right? I hope so, because it's being recorded. So most of your people are right there in the middle. So they're taking your vision in doses. They're sizing you up. They're trying to decide how much they trust you. It's not like you're a raving lunatic. So it's not like they've dismissed trust completely, but they're like, do we want to change my whole life over this or the whole association over this? So they're still sizing you up. That means they need to be encouraged. You know, and you'll notice encouragement pretty high on all these. It's a core leadership activity. You have to serve these people. You have to make it look like, and I mean, you have to, with integrity, make the vision look like it really is beneficial. You know? And so you have to serve them. You have to equip them. Because it is from this middle group that you will get your next supply of front group people. Right? Your future scouts are coming out of the middle group. They're not coming out of the back group. More often than not. I would say the vast majority of time. And so you've got to equip these people, and you have to some measure, but maybe a little less, resource them so that they can see, if I'm going to invest time in accomplishing this vision because I trust this guy and he's served me well, he's teaching me these things, and I guess I need to play with it a little bit. I guess I need to figure it out. You know, these are, you know, to do the sports analogy, this is your scout team. This is your farm team. You know, this is your AAA baseball team. You equip them, and then in doses, you give them kind of live fire, you know, real competition. And be prepared to encourage the heck out of them. You know, the first time that you're, you know, hitting home runs and jacking everything out of the park at AAA, and the first time you come up against someone who throws a 95-mile-an-hour fastball right by your chin, and the world is different for you, you're like, whoa. In the last league, it looked like I was trying to hit watermelons, and now I think this guy's throwing golf balls. You got to be able to encourage them, but give them some resourcing. So now I just want to go back real quick. So front group, middle group, back group. Push back on this. Tell me where we have missed it. What is the question that you come up with as we look at back, middle, and front? Nobody?
How do you define the difference between your fourth group and your back group? Is there a third?
So, people in the back group will give you, will credit you as their leader. Okay? Now, so, when I think of the back group, I intuitively think of the little old lady who has been at the church for 50 years, and you get there as the new pastor, and she sizes you up immediately, right? She's like, I've seen a dozen of you people. You know, if you're near a seminary town, she's like, I've seen 3 dozen of you people in my lifetime. I will be here long after you move on. But, she says, but let's see what you got, pastor. That's a back group person. Now, she's going to sit there like this. You know, I had one in the first church that I pastored. I had a guy who loved me. There was no question that he loved me. But he was standing at the back door after every sermon with whatever I said wrong. You know, and so like 1 week I got Sarah's age wrong. And he was standing in the back and go, actually, she was this old. And I was like, okay, I'll clean that up at the next service. Thank you. But like, you know, his name was Jim. Jim just had to say something. Had to say something. But he loved me. Now, did he trust me enough to execute vision? No. Was he leaving the church over me? No. He was like, let's see what the kid's got. And I was 22, you know, so it was a kid. Now, I served him, equipped him, put him on committees. You know, he was a resource to our church, and we gave him opportunities to work within our church. And he eventually didn't stay in the back group. Now, wish I could say that about all people I've ever encountered in a back group, but I can't. Now, the people in the fourth group are the ones who give you 2 weeks and then bolt. You know? They're leaving the church over, you know, whatever it is. Oh, I can't stand the way he does this. Or, you know, pick a thing. You've all heard the nightmare stories. The people who leave are in the fourth group because they have removed themselves from this tribe that is moving from A to B. Does that make sense? Yeah. Any other questions? Push back on this. I'll just take my word for it. Yeah.
Question that I think will lead to a more specific question. In the world of leadership, it kind of has the idea that it needs to be more of a collaborative, gather the group, figure it out together, rather than Moses going to the mountain, here's where we're going. And I'm not pushing on whether that's right or wrong.
Sure.
What happens when you misread as a leader somebody who is, you think is in the back group and they're actually in the first group saying, would you just help put the vision out there and quit trying to collaborate so much and I'm ready to roll, man, let's go. Like, what happens when you confuse those two?
Yeah. You be humble, you say sorry, you put it back together. I'll give you a good example. So we, in my association, there was a big debate 10 years ago whether we were going to survive into the future. Okay, now, have a big association, all this, but the team had all worked together for 20 years. So I was the new guy for 11 years. So I come into this incredibly stable staff, all boomer generation, and this isn't a boomer joke, they were all boomer generation. And so here I am at the back of the extra generation, and my leader beforehand says, he pitches something out to a room about this big, talks about the future of the association, and one pastor makes the crack. He's like, what are we even got to worry about this for? 10 years, we'll all be gone, and it'll be Josh's problem. And the whole room laughed. I didn't laugh, because he wasn't wrong. You know, I was like, holy cow, everybody in this room is going to retire in 10 years. You know, this is the guts of the association. And so we started looking at why, as a result of that conversation, we started looking at why churches relate to us, why they collaborate with us. And we had four categories, and we defined it by missional affinity or historic affinity. And what we put churches in the different quadrants. So if you're, you know, well, we did it with funding and affinity. So whether you are historic affinity, you're just a good Baptist and you're part of the association, that's what you do. Or missional affinity, you know the mission, you're in on the mission, and we're doing it. So if you make a matrix with that on one index and then funding on the other, we had some that were completely bought in on the mission vision and funded us next to nothing. We also had others that were just good Baptists and didn't have any idea what we did, you know. So one church, we did that all while I was an associate director, so I become the executive director. And I go to meet with this historic affinity church. And he's a good old boy, pastors this massive church, and they give us a chunk of money. And so I'm already intimidated, and I walk in there, and he sits down with a manila folder. He had printed out pages from our website. He had gotten our budget. And I'm like, oh, I am about to get the third degree. And he opens all this stuff, and I'm like, he's got a little dossier on me. And I said, man, I just wanted to meet you. I've never met you. You were kind of in Tom's portfolio. And he goes, yeah, why is that? And I was like, oh, here we go. We're off to the races. Because I'm like, this guy's a back group if there is a back group, right? Like, he's the chief of the back group. And over the course of that conversation, He's not in the back group. We had assigned him the back group. We had totally misread that. Now, I don't use this terminology for him, but that's what we had done. And over the course of one conversation, he went from the back group to the front group. And I was like, man, that is just on me. Like, completely on me. They are now one of our best churches. They have two things in their budget for us. They have one normal general fund giving, and they have another one that they just set a pot aside. Anytime we want to do replanting, we come to them. We would never, ever have had that kind of relationship if I hadn't first tried to understand where they were and also reality checked my own assumption by having that conversation. And I was totally wrong. And my predecessor was totally wrong. And if he was here today, I would say that to his face. I mean, we both know that. So what do you do when you miscategorize someone? And this is why I say this is not like a personality test, right? There's no inventory I can give you to size up whether someone's in the front, the back, or the middle. You know, they're going to demonstrate that. And they're going to change, right? Like, I get the question most times that I say anything about this. Do you want everybody in the front group? Right? Like, are you trying to progress everybody from the back to the middle to the front? Now, why don't you want everybody in the front group? You tell me. Some of you were immediately like, no. Give me a reason. Come on, Ron. Give it to me. Why don't you want everybody to be a scout?
Too many chiefs.
So front group are like mini chiefs, right? Like once you give them something, they're going to execute, they're going to go, they want some bandwidth. But also, people in the front group don't want to be on their own, right? So they're not going to leave your group as a scout and then go do something off on their own. They want to accomplish what the team is trying to accomplish, okay? So the instinct is right, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say from the hiking illustration, if everybody's leading from the front, you're trying to lead from the middle, you'd be exhausted then. Yeah.
You would, for sure. Yeah.
What about was, you're going to have some people who are scouts, who are out there doing things, and they're going to make some mistakes. They're bound to.
Yes.
Because that's part of, you know, treading new territory nobody's been in. If your whole group did that, it could be a mess.
Yeah.
But if you've got a group that's a little less aggressive and they can learn from these guys, then they can implement some of those things in a much better manner and you have stability out of that.
Yeah, I mean, so I would never hold someone back from being in the front group. You'll lose them. Like, you'll lose them the next day. But I don't make any attempt to get everybody to be a scout, because being a scout's hard, for one thing. Some people aren't geared to be a scout. Scout is unsafe. You know, like, if your whole tribe that you're leading is in the front group and they all rush down into the valley, who's going to be the one to say, stop, there's water down there? You know? Well, the first scout that hits the water. But all of them are scouts, and so splash, now you've got a big wet tribe because no one was in the middle and no one was saying, hey, maybe there should just be a couple of you going out to execute that. You know? Also, you have to, as a leader, the burden on you to give enough ammunition to that whole scout group would be enormous. Right? Now, you may have some projects and some other things that you're like, man, I don't need just one scout for this, I need five. You know, that's fine, but rarely are you going to find, I can't think of a context, that you would have everybody needing to be in, all in, no vision, no equipping necessary, none of that. I mean, these are your, this is your front group right here. You know, it's just against human nature, frankly, for everybody to be a scout. Now, they may come in and out, and that's okay, but yeah.
Well, the problem is too, if you're talking about a church ministry, you can't have everybody do a youth ministry running that vision, running the vision of that, you know, and everything, all the rest of the ministry doesn't get fulfilled.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. So I was going to say, too, there are people in the back group that need care. And so one of the ways that this analogy kind of breaks down but kind of doesn't is you may need some scouts to hang with the back group. Because you as a leader can't be at both extremes of your tribe at all times. Now, I do think you need to vacillate a little bit. You know, you can't lose touch with the people in the back. You can't lose touch with the people in the front. But there need to be, I mean, this is where chaplains serve more often than not. Some of them are scouts, but some of them are just in the back going, it's going to be okay. You know, Josh seems crazy, but he's not, you know, like, let's take a step. So you've got to be doing some care in the back, and you can't always be the person to do that. Well, wounded don't tend to wounded very well, right? And hurt definitely don't tend to hurt well. Hurt people hurt people. And so you've got to have people that you cast a vision, that you build up, that you equip, and when you resource them, you say, and by the way, your environment is the back. Like, I got to have you in the back. You've got to have high-performing leaders in the back group, otherwise that group gets left behind. And they probably get left behind in a bitter and angry way, right? And that's not good for the people that are in your charge, your team, your tribe, whatever analogy you want to use. So that's why I'm not super concerned. Now, I'm great if people come from the middle and they go to the back as intentional leaders, and I'm great if people go from the middle and they go to the front and they execute. But I have no, this is not a continuum, right? What else? Good questions. Yeah.
These seem like you're looking for disagreement, so I'll throw a disagreement out.
Come on.
I don't think that this is goes against your model here, because I don't necessarily think the scouts, as you're calling them, are very good caregivers. So I think the people
sure.
who are in that middle group, whose arms length away, if you will, provide the better care for that group than probably a scout and personality type, and they're
sure.
like, you're holding us back, you know. Let's get going. And
Yes, I totally agree with all of that. Until you encounter a scout who has a passion for the back group. Which happens, you know? You're going to somebody and go, hey, you know, I mean, this is how we got deacons, right? People's well, yes. But, I mean, people spoke up and said, hey, there are people getting missed. What are you going to do about it? And so then they tapped the deacons to say, to make sure that the back group is taken care of, because they're missing meals and that's not okay. You know? Yeah. Come on, Richard.
Since you used the sports analogy, to me it would be like that sixth man on the basketball team.
Yes.
Who's good enough to be a starter, but he has accepted the role of leading that second team.
Sure.
When they're on.
Yeah.
He's the leader of the second group.
Yeah. 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 No, I like that. What else?
Is it also depending on the vision that's being cast? In the sports analogy, there were offensive players who were front group and defensive people who were middle on the sideline. But then when the defense is on the field, those roles are reversed, right? So it depends
sure.
on what hill we're trying to take, right?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Josh, I'm on a question. This is what they need, right? This is the graph of...
This is front group. This is back group.
Okay. But it's what they need to be successful in what they're... Or to be moved along.
To be led well.
To be led
yes.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think your point, I may be pushing your point here.
That's right.
The middle is the easy way because it affects for all of us. Is that correct? Is that how... That's what you're talking about, leading from the middle?
No. So I say... Whoops, sorry. I say lead from the middle... Because you as a leader have to be positioned close enough to the back group to know what they need and close enough to the front group to let them do what they need to do, which is to lead them well. And so the leadership tendency and most of what you're going to read in leadership literature naturally puts leaders in the front, you know, because they're like, I'm going to show you the way. I'm going to take that hill with you. Let's go. Everybody go that way. So what I wrote in your books are, you need a front guy to yell fire when he sees smoke and show the door, right? You need a leader in the back group to make sure that everybody gets out of the building. Because your front group guys, they're already gone. They're out. You know, and they're, you know, the middle guys are following them. But somebody back here has got to make sure that the back group gets out, right? So you need leaders in each of those, but you lead them differently and you lead the groups differently. So I hope this has been helpful to you. Yeah, go ahead.
As we deal with people, depending on the project, they can be in different groups.
For sure, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this isn't a personality test. Nobody is a scout all the time. Nobody's bad group all the time. There's a couple of exceptions you're probably thinking of, but for the most part, right? Yes, it's absolutely going to change based on the context, which is why when you go back to that leadership equation, right, it's your character working on this ratio between the six consistent activities that constantly change depending on the context, which is the group. Fair enough? All right, that's all I've got. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it. Now's the break until 4:30, I think. Is that right?
45.
4:45. Okay, you got a big long break. I'll be up here if you got questions.